Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
The Guardian.
Hello. And a happy new year, albeit slightly belated to all. This is Brexit Means, The Guardian's regular dispatch from Brexit land, back in your ears for its very first episode of 2018, the year that will make or break Brexit. In fact, of course, it's more like the 10 months that will make or break Brexit. With the Article 50 divorce talks over, although with a number of potentially problematic loose ends still to tie up, which we'll come to in a bit, the UK and the EU need to sign off on that separation agreement and settle on at least an outline of future trading ties by October. And that's a deadline that's going to have to be respected if all 28 capitals, including London, are to get time to approve it before Britain leaves at the end of March 2019. That's a lot to get through, and there's a lot that could go wrong. So, with me to discuss what the coming few months might hold and all the latest Brexit developments are The Guardian's Brexit correspondent Lisa O'Carroll and Brussels Bureau Chief Dan Boffey. Welcome both. Let's start with the news then. Theresa May's much-heralded cabinet reshuffle first. Now, the general verdict seems to be fairly underwhelming and with not many implications for Brexit. The key players on either side of the debate, I suppose that would be David Davis, Boris Johnson on the one hand, Philip Hammond, Amber Rudd on the other, they all remain in place, and the broad balance in the cabinet between leavers and remainers is pretty much maintained. But there are a couple of things to note. The appointment of David Lidington, for example, a former Europe minister who campaigned against leaving the EU, to the position of de facto deputy PM. And the departure of Justine Greening, the education secretary, to the backbenches, where as a highly disgruntled, one imagines, ex-cabinet minister and a very eloquent remainer, she could start causing all kinds of trouble. Any thoughts on that, Lisa? And also, might the new Northern Ireland secretary make any difference there in what looks set to be a really critical Brexit issue?
Well, on the general point first, I think, as you said, everybody here is describing it as underwhelming. There was a very funny line in a column by Anne McElvoy before the reshuffle, describing reshuffles in January as similar to diets for civilians. So it's an opportunity missed. It was... I think the most significant thing in the reshuffle was, apart from the Damien Green, David Lidington swap, was the number of vice chair. If you look at a photograph of that, the vice chair, James Cleverly, being the deputy chairman
of the Conservative Party.
Yes. I think that's what's interesting in terms of where the Tory party sees their failures in terms of the election last June.
So for you, it was more about the party than about the government?
I think so. On the Northern Ireland point, I also thought it was really interesting, having read all the columns, political columns in the main papers today, Northern Ireland, James Brokenshire and his replacement, Karen Bradley, don't get a mention anywhere, which shows you back to normal business. Northern Ireland doesn't really score very highly in the general narrative in Britain. That said, Karen Bradley has got an extremely big challenge ahead of her. I noticed that William Hague in the Telegraph gave his advice to incoming ministers this morning, said, listen to your civil servants, give yourself 6 weeks to read in and work out where you want to be in 2 years, because the 2 year time frame is where all ministers should expect to be either sacked or promoted. And unfortunately, none of the ministers have that. They have 10 months. And in Northern Ireland, we're looking at, you know, much, much shorter time frame. The 10th of January tomorrow is the first anniversary of Martin McGuinness imploding the assembly there. They're a year without local government. The threat of direct rule looms large in the background. And there are tough decisions that Karen Bradley may have to make.
To make.
Yeah.
And is that going to play into Brexit at all? Or do you think not?
Well, I think the fact that she is a loyal and trusted colleague from Theresa May's Home Office days shows that May didn't want to risk Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland has got a very obvious potential to be a landmine. It still is a landmine in talks. They didn't solve the issue. They came up with some words, but the actual...
The issue remains, the fundamentals of the issue are still there, aren't they?
On the border.
Okay, Dan, perhaps one of the other most striking things about this reshuffle was the way it seems to have demonstrated how little authority Theresa May actually has over her ministers. I mean, several of them simply refused to move and ended up staying where they were. Do you think that's the most significant message that Brussels will take away from this?
I don't think they needed any reminder of how weak she was. I mean, that was really sort of laid bare very clearly when the DUP pulled the rug under on that day when we thought we had agreement on the first phase, ahead of Christmas, and then it all fell apart when Arlene Foster said no. So I don't think there's anything new on that for them. They will be pleased, actually, in a way that the current negotiating team in the UK hasn't changed. They're not particularly fond of David Davis. The relationship between him and Michel Barnier is working, you know, workmanlike, nothing more than that. But change would not have been welcome here. You know, had enough of that. David Lidington will be a welcome new face.
I mean, he knows Europe. He knows Europe very well. Standing
minister for the EU. That the British government ever had, and he's extremely well liked over here, extremely well respected. So that's good news. It looks like Ollie Robbins, sort of little talk that Ollie Robbins has sort of even strengthened his position. He's got during this process, so that they'll be pleased with that because they like him. But the weakness aspect that they all knew about already, that's really going to come to the fore. So you know, there maybe is a bit of foreboding here, a bit of forewarning. That's really going to come to a fore in this next few months, because it's a cake and eat it philosophy where Theresa May could pretend to the cabinet that everything will be exactly as it is, but even better. That's not going to last much longer. The reality is going to hit, and when reality hits, then you know all the different cabinet ministers go off on their own little journey and they tell their own little stories, and it all falls apart. So that'll be the worry here. But otherwise. Not much to see.
Fine. Okay, let's just have a little recap of what news there was over the holiday period. There wasn't a lot, to be honest, as far as Brexit was concerned, bar perhaps the resignation, the quite sort of spectacular, or at least highly publicised resignation of the Labour peer Andrew Adonis as the government's kind of infrastructure czar. He used particularly colourful language that was obviously seized on by anti-Brexiters. He described Brexit as a national spasm that was causing a kind of nervous breakdown in Whitehall. And he said that the EU withdrawal bill, government's EU withdrawal bill, was the worst legislation of my lifetime. So that was year-end fireworks. David Davis also raised a few eyebrows. He rather cheekily nicked the Commission's negotiating motto, no cherry-picking, against the bloc. He said it was the EU that wouldn't be able to cherry-pick in a future trading relationship because the UK would simply refuse to accept any deal that didn't include services. A few eyebrows raised at that, and he's raised a few more this week with a leaked letter to Theresa May complaining rather extraordinarily about the EU's preparations for a no deal. Now, that might strike some as a little bit rich, coming from a government that spent much of last year shouting that no deal was better than a bad deal. But Dan, can you fill us in a little bit on this? I know you've been writing about it. What did the letter actually say, and how has it gone down in Brussels?
It's gone down appallingly badly. I can't believe they would want this out, and the timing's poor. So the letter essentially said that the EU was discriminating against the UK while it was still a member of the bloc by warning businesses of the consequences of no deal, by warning businesses that on the 29th of March 2019, the UK will leave the bloc and there will be consequences for that. And to be honest, all the warnings that the EU has provided to businesses, they have mentioned that they hope to have a transition period, but they've just been making it clear that there are repercussions for the UK no longer being an EU member. Davis was in his letter saying that he wanted the EU to retract those warnings, that he had taken legal advice and government lawyers had advised him that he was probably not on great ground, but he was nevertheless going to pursue this with the Commission. The Commission this week responded saying there's no discrimination whatsoever. All we've done is respond to Theresa May's repeated warnings in two major speeches, the Lancaster House speech and the Florence speech, that the British government believed that no deal was better than a bad deal, and therefore the EU was just doing the preparations they needed to do, just in case. You know, they're surprised that the UK is surprised. They furthermore say that they're not going to withdraw any of their warnings, and I think they just want Britain to get serious. And it seems odd that this has come out, that Davis is wasting his time on this. There are so many bigger things. I mean, the UK does have one point in this, in that in some contracts recently, for example, with Galileo, this big satellite project, a £10 billion project for an EU satellite, and in the contracts for that to various companies around the EU, the Commission has included a clause saying that should the company belong to a member state that falls out of the EU, then that company could lose its contract. And legal experts say, well, that could potentially...
It might be on slightly dodgy ground.
There might be something dodgy in it, but it's a small feed. It's not a massive amount of money. It's not big picture. Why is the Brexit Secretary worrying about this sort of stuff?
I mean, the optics of this must be terrible in Brussels, aren't they? I mean, because it's the British government complaining about something that it has itself been calling for, or at least warning of, and some parts of the government preaching for the last several months.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there was suggestions there'd be a minister for no deal, and the timing seems odd in that. Apparently, David Davis and Philip Hammond in the next few days are doing a little tour of Europe and are trying to sort of change the rhetoric. They're going to appeal to the EU to put aside all the grandstanding of the first phase and sort of get real and be all sensible and grown up. And then you've got this sort of nonsense. It really does sets a bad tone for the next year.
It doesn't make the government look very serious, does it? Lisa, anything further to say?
Yeah, a couple of things. I also I agree with them, Dan. What is he doing? But also, I thought what was interesting was the leak itself. Over the Christmas, we had more sort of muttering about David Davis's position. And in recent days, we had speculation that Steve Baker, one of his ministers, was going to be moved and become an official no-deal minister. And this has been seen as yet another move to undermine his department or to weaken his department after Theresa May pulled Ollie Robbins away from him and gave
took him into number 10. Yeah,
exactly. So I thought the leak was interesting, who leaked it and what was its purpose. But also, the timing of it is completely wrong. This is something that they should have done a year, 18 months ago. Right now, January, all the banks are making, in the first quarter of this year, are likely to make decisions on whether they're going to be moving substantive parts of their businesses out from the Canary Wharf in the city to wherever in Europe. There are real decisions being made. The businesses in this country have been warning about this for over a year now. And these are the kind of things that the government should be
tackling. Faffing around with this kind of stuff is really, really...
And Juncker again this week reminded Britain that there would be no deal for financial services. It's not part of the EU's plan at all.
Yeah. So typically sort of bombastic David Davis, really. While we're on bombast, I know that you wanted to have a word about Jeremy Corbyn and Labour. You were very disappointed in the Labour leader's statement this week.
I just thought that it was a very significant story yesterday. Rowena Mason, our deputy political editor, wrote about it. He told colleagues that it wasn't possible to stay in the single market. A source is saying the single market is not a membership club, that we can be joined. And I think this goes to the point about the Corbyn Labour Party, or Corbyn and etc., seeing the European Union as a capitalist membership club. And I think what not so much disappointing for me personally, but I think for Remainers is that it kind of puts the kibosh on any sort of scintilla of the Labour Party turning to the Blair view and possibly becoming a real opposition to Brexit. And I also thought it was, you know, you mentioned Andrew Adonis's remarks before Christmas, but also let's not forget Tony Blair has been out and again calling for the Labour Party to review its position. He has outlined things, as Martin Kettle said, he is, you know, Tony Blair is damaged permanently because of Iraq, but yet he is articulating things better than anybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
And he talked about four options that Blair has set out for Britain: remain and reform, which is something that Cameron had obviously tried to do, leave, but stay in the single market and the customs union. And I sincerely believe that a lot of people in the Labour Party think that that is an option that the Labour Party should still be pursuing.
Mm-hmm.
Exit all structures, but make a bespoke deal. And the fourth one, make a virtue of leaving, i.e. Do a massive PR job on why it is a good thing. And, you know, the Tories could, I was reminded in Ireland over Christmas that they could harness arguments, that there are really good arguments against the EU. And one of them is the deepening federalisation of the EU. That is an argument that we don't hear in this country, but it's something that is going to be quite strong in other countries.
Yeah. And Labour's position, you know, Labour's position does matter, because this coming year I'm going to ask you both to sort of gaze into the crystal ball a little bit, but it's very, very difficult to know what's going to happen, because so many things could go wrong. So many different eventualities could come to pass. I mean, let's cast ourselves forward a little bit, if we can. Dan, concretely first, the first steps in the new year are going to be the transition deal, aren't they? And I know that, you know, the UK is still officially saying that it wants more than an outline trade deal. But given that, you know, the time constraints, that looks all but impossible. But Theresa May said she wants the transition deal or the implementation period agreed by the end of March. I believe the Commission said the same. Is that going to happen? Does that look likely to you?
I think March is doable, but that depends on whether there are any surprises. And I think the lesson we've learned from the last 10 months is that the negotiations constantly bring up surprises. I mean, if you think back, you've got Gibraltar and all sorts of, and Ireland just suddenly pop up out of nowhere, and it causes massive delays and uncertainty.
Distractions and
But there, at the moment, yes. So the transition is the main feast for the next 3 months, 2.5 months. But there are other things going on. So there are still loose ends from the first phase that need to be tightened up. The European Parliament is still concerned about the administration for citizens in the EU citizens in the UK and the costs and stuff like that. Right at the moment, the Commission is drafting a treaty which will put into legal language all the agreements of the first phase. Now, that actually, then the UK will be involved in drafting that treaty as well. And the problem is, you know, then you're really putting things into legally certain terms. And so any ambiguity in the joint document that was published before Christmas, that'll jump out, and there are bound to be disagreements around the wording. So that could cause problems. Then there are just issues that were meant to be settled in the first phase. There weren't the three big issues, that being citizens' rights, financial settlement, and the Irish border. But there were other issues that were meant to be dealt with, such as Euratom, which weren't at all, really, didn't get anywhere near it. So they'll have to be sorted out. And things like goods on the market, goods that are already in the market when the UK leaves, and they've got the branding, EU branding and all that sort of stuff. Do they still, in the UK, do they still...
How do you treat those?
That still needs to be dealt with. And then, so you've got all that stuff, and then you've got the terms of the transition deal to be sorted at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the transition deal, I don't think there's too much difference between the UK and the EU on it, you know, status quo. But things like aviation, is that going to be covered?
Mm-hmm.
No. That might cause some upset in London, and there are things, you know, treaties, third-party free trade treaties around the world. As it stands, the logic would be that we would fall out of all those treaties. We're no longer an EU member, so any EU, say Japan treaty, we'd fall out of that. Are you going to help us out and keep us in those or not? That needs to be discussed.
Yeah.
I suspect the EU will yes, you should stay in for the transition period. But ultimately, I think March, we'll get to March, and I don't think there'll be too much issue on the transition period. And hopefully none of those big surprises of the last first phase will jump up. I mean, we'll get it. But then reality hits. Honestly, March is when it's all going to,
it's all going to kick off in March. Yeah,
again.
It is true that, you know, as I said, there's a lot that could still go wrong. I mean, and Lisa, you alluded to it, obviously, and so did you, Dan, with this old cake and eat it business. I mean, you know, the problem here really is that Britain continues to insist it wants this creative, sort of deep and special relationship, hanging on to most of the benefits of EU membership, but its own red lines preclude staying in the single market. And, you know, then beyond, above and beyond that, without customs union with the EU, there's no solution in sight for the Irish border. And there's no indication of how the Prime Minister can possibly keep all three of the DUP, which her majority depends on, and the Irish government, and her own Brexiters happy. Now, the EU has made it abundantly clear that those UK red lines, which are basically about, as the government puts it, taking back control of borders, money and laws, pretty much mean that the only future relationship that can be on the table is a trade deal along the lines of Canada's. Maybe a bit of extra cooperation in areas like defence and justice, but with customs barriers and minus any real provision for the services that are so critically important to the UK economy. Lisa, turning to you, you know, beyond the transition deal, which, as Dan said, looks to be, you know, the least of the government's problems over the next few months, do you think it remains the case that the government, you know, is going to have to finally sort out what it actually wants and agree what it actually wants from Brexit over the next few months? And does it boil down to this difference, which seems to have been kind of clarified, I suppose, at the end of last year, between basically those who want to align Britain as closely as possible with Europe and those who seek to diverge over the medium and long term?
Yes, exactly. As we've said before, I suppose when we get down to the discussions about the trade and the other issues, it's where the reality hits Brexit fantasy. So at the moment, we're still in this kind of fantasy territory where there is political capital in saying that we're out of the single market, we're out of the customs union, we're washing our hands clean of the EU. But the reality of being out of that is the cold, isolated position. And, you know, being a third country outside of the EU compared to being within the EU and having deals with 60 countries, it's going to be a lonely place, and it's going to be a tough place to be.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think as the details of that kind of existence come through, as you know, sink in, that's where
the problems might start to arise.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well,
as the shape of the final deal becomes clearer, a lot of things will start to fall into place. And it's possible, Dan, isn't it, that you know, I would imagine it's perfectly possible that if that deal, shape of that deal, a kind of basically a Canada style deal, starts to become clear, then, you know, that surely there'll be plenty of pro-Brexit campaigners in the UK who are going to start questioning whether it's worth paying the 40 billion quid that Britain basically agreed to pay up as a financial settlement at the end of last year. It's possible that the talks could break down before October, that Theresa May's government could fall, even that the UK could completely walk out. What do you think the EU is expecting over the coming months? Any of those events, any of those eventualities, those combinations, are there scenarios that it thinks are more likely than others?
Yeah, I mean, one senior official just said, just expects a horrible mess. And it's not so much Britain walking out. You know, you just could run to the end of the line and nothing getting sorted, just because you've got the internal debate in the UK and the failure to understand the reality or to accept the reality of the situation. You know, if you leave the customs union, you can't then reinvent all the benefits of the customs union while having trade deals with the rest of the world, etc. The UK internal debate has been an issue throughout and will remain an issue, and the stark differences in the cabinet will become very clear. And as you say, people will start questioning whether 40 billion is this what's being offered worth it. But then what didn't happen in the first phase very much, it happened in the margins, but in the second phase, we're going to see the EU fracturing. I have no doubt in my mind.
I was going to ask, yeah, that's right. Because Emmanuel Macron, he warned about this last week. He said that there was a real danger that as individual member states in the EU27 start to look after their own interests, that kind of unity that was so striking in the first round might start to weaken.
It's already happened. It's already started to happen that Michel Barnier today was with the Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, and that's no great surprise because the Dutch are probably our closest allies have been in the EU, along with Denmark, and they want a comprehensive. You know, they would be, if anything, they'll be sort of batting for us. That's not what they say in public, but behind the scenes, they're not particularly pleased with the line being taken by Germany and France on financial services, for example. Mm-hmm. In terms of checks and customs, you know, it's really important for them that trade flows nice and smoothly. So I can see the fractures are already appearing. So Bonnier has a very big task. Then you've got that going on. And then I think Lisa mentioned it earlier that the issue of Ireland was just fudged in the last round. And everybody says it. It just shows, the Irish issue shows, in the words of one senior official, the unfeasibility of Brexit, because the fudge they came up with we'll come up with something later on, or we won't have a hard border because we'll come up with a trade deal that sorts it out. It's just not going to happen. And so they ended up, Britain has ended up saying, well, we'll have complete alignment with the EU and that's how we'll deal with it if worst comes to worst. Well, that's just being an EU member. Mm. So Ireland is going to explode as well in the second part. Ireland doesn't have a veto on a final deal. It's a qualified majority of member states will have to do it. But the way this is working is that Ireland's voice will be important. There are a myriad number of ways this could all go horribly wrong.
Lisa, do you see, just briefly, we're sort of wrapping up now, do you see Ireland as the major stumbling block?
I was just going to say, I'm currently reading, I thought I should, Jonathan Powell's book on the negotiation of the Good Friday Agreement, and it is fascinating. So, you know, it's the ultimate chronicle of brinkmanship, hyper-brinkmanship, super-brinkmanship, and how many times Sinn Féin and the DUP and everybody walked away and were saying one thing publicly, but meanwhile were promising another thing behind the scenes. And I think what is clear from the book is that what carried everybody over the line, and, you know, let's not forget arms were involved, was a vision. There was a vision. And there was somebody at the helm, Tony Blair, who was very committed to the vision. And that's what's lacking here. The Tory party have not articulated what that vision is. And if that, I think that's what Tony Blair is talking about when he says, make it a virtue of leaving. What is Britain's vision?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it is articulating visions, but none of them are particularly realistic, I suppose. Okay, well, that's about it for this week. Thanks very much. My thanks to Lisa and Dan for joining me today. Please do subscribe, review on all your favourite podcatchers, join the discussion on Twitter. You just need to search for Guardian Podcasts. If you want to get in touch with us, it's Brexit Podcast. That's all one word, brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. Till next week, then. I'm John Henley. The producer was Rowan Slaney. This was Brexit Means, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.